UAA Podcasting is brought to you by University Advancement.
Howard Weaver, former editor of the Anchorage Daily News and a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner for his newspaper's work in Alaska, is interviewed here by Julia O'Malley, president of the Alaska Press Club. He was back in Alaska to promote his book, Write Hard, Die Free, a memoir of the Alaska newspaper war between the ADN and the now-defunct Anchorage Times. This event was a part of the Alaska Press Club J Week Conference of 2012. The podcast was recorded at the UAA Campus Bookstore on April 20th, 2012. Thanks for coming. We're super lucky to have such an amazing audience this afternoon. This is an event as part of the Alaska Press Club Conference, but also it's a stop on the illustrious Howard Weaver's book tour. I am just wanting to let you know that we have passed out throughout the audience some little cards. And if you have questions that you'd like for me to ask Howard toward the end of this conversation, just let's pass them up. So has anybody written down things they want to ask already? Pass them up. Pass them if you don't mind, because let's ask. So the theme for our conference this year is ask. That's why we thought we would do this as a conversation. And so without any more, one question. I pass out a big old stack of paper. All right. Okay. So I present to you Howard, who is a former. Are you gonna? We don't know what we're doing if we're sitting or standing. Can everybody see? No. Okay. Now can you see? Okay. Should we stand like right here?
Well, you know, Julia, actually.
I feel weird.
You could stand and I could sit, and I think they could still see us.
So. Good one. That's never been told before. Okay, so Howard is a former editor of the Anchorage Daily News. During that time, he won two Pulitzer Prizes, and he went on to become the vice president for news at McClatchy Newspapers, the third largest newspaper chain in the country. And now he has written a memoir about his experiences in Alaska during the newspaper war with the Times. So I thought we would just start. I feel like I'm supposed to do a little dance. Okay.
If one of us does, it'll be you.
Oh, really? The first thing I was hoping that you could talk about, one of my favorite parts of your book was how you described the newsroom in the beginning and your impressions of it. Could you just describe that
sure.
a little bit?
It's really, I think, in the nature of an excuse for how I managed to spend 40 years of my life doing this, because I truly sort of found religion when I walked into the newsroom at the Daily News for the first time. I actually started working for the paper while I was still in high school. I was at East Anchorage High School, and I played football in the fall, but I didn't play any winter sports, and so I had some time on my hands. I started working for the student newspaper, and I met somebody from the Daily News who happened to be the sports editor, and he needed high school sports covered, and he didn't know any other high school kids, and so I started doing that. I don't recall that I made very much money at that, but they put my name in the paper, and that was pretty seductive to me. I didn't intend to be a journalist, however. I went away to college, studied other things, never took a journalism class, but at some point started working at the Daily News in the summers, covering the Glacier Pilots and a few other things. And then when I graduated, within 2 weeks I was back there in the newsroom, and it was really like being struck down with some kind of revelation or something. It was very clear to me that this is where I belonged, and these people were the first people in a long time that had ever felt like I sort of understood them and they understood me, and it was thrilling to be there. And I was the kid. I was one of the only locals on the staff. I think, looking back on it, I was probably, they thought of me as some kind of pet or something like that. But I got a chance to do what I could do. And like a lot of things in Alaska, you don't really have to ask permission. You can do them. And I was a very fortunate recipient of that.
What did it like look like and smell like and feel like to be in that newsroom?
I'll concentrate on the physical environment. How's that?
All right. The
Daily News in those days had a newspaper office down in the Warehouse District on Post Road, quite a ways from downtown in those days. And, of course, it had the printing facilities there as well. I feel really lucky that I got to work at a newspaper where they made the newspaper out of molted lead. They still had the big old linotype machines that one letter at a time would flip up there and make a line of type. About 8 per minute was as fast as they could go. And the paper would get printed that way. Got to be one of the last journalists in America who actually worked at a newspaper like that, because Alaska was fairly behind the country anyway. The Times had already gone to photo offset by then. But so I got to work there, and I got to work with these craftsmen in the back shop who were typesetters. And it wasn't just a job to them. They were a part of the printing business, the literary world. And these guys, you'd go back there at lunchtime, and they'd be sitting by these big old greasy machines playing chess and reading Dostoevsky and stuff. And it was really very cool. And so I was completely infatuated by this, despite the fact that at the first I didn't have a desk. The newsroom was very small, and I was kind of hired, I guess, under the table or off the cuff or something like that. And so I would move from desk to desk as people came back to the office. And I didn't know how to touch type, which I still don't. And so they would delight in giving me one of the typewriters where all the keys had been worn smooth. So I'm sitting there going, is this the A or the S, you know, and trying to figure it out. But all of those things combined to you know, to create a situation where if you succeeded, you really felt good about it. And to me, these people were really exalted characters. I mean, one of them had worked at Time magazine. I'm from Muldoon, right? I grew up in Alaska. I was very impressed to see. She had written a cover story in Time magazine on the Beatles.
Whoa.
You know, it wasn't going to get any better than that in my career, and in some ways didn't. But there were, you know, another guy had been a foreign correspondent for UPI in Oslo. And that was also remarkable to me. And so I just loved being around these guys. They also liked to drink, and I enjoyed that too. And so that was a part of it. They did a lot of drinking in those days. We all did. And people would have martini lunches. And it wasn't quite Mad Men, but it was definitely a different era. And I felt like I belonged there. 40-some years later, I'm quite sure that that was true.
Another part of your book that really struck me, still working at the Daily News, having been at the Daily News since you left there, was the part of your book where you talk about building a culture, building a newsroom culture. And I was wondering if you could just talk about the values that you think are important to have in a newsroom, and especially a newsroom that's ambitious and that wins Pulitzers.
Well, it gives me a chance to say a couple things, if I may. And one is that I think, you know, journalism is obviously in a huge transition right now. The era of the newspaper I worked at is gone, and something else is going to emerge. And we can talk about that, I hope, later. But one of the reasons I have mourned it so much is because I know better than almost anybody gets a chance to know how powerful a large, good-functioning newsroom is. And it is truly one of those things that is far greater than the sum of its parts. It's a place where, as I describe in the book, people hold one another accountable. It's not a top-down situation. I mean, somebody has to make a decision at deadline time, does the story go or not? And so it has that kind of hierarchy. But in terms of where the aspirations rest and where the pride in the work comes from and where the standards get established, it's very much a collegial process. And I guess I knew intuitively, maybe, or just got lucky, because when I first started, I recognized that I think I actually did a little calculation in my head, and I figured I could personally make about 5% difference in the newspaper. And I could think of that many story ideas or write that many headlines or, you know, do enough to make some difference. But it wasn't going to be decisive in any way. What I really could do that was going to make a difference was try and create an environment where other people could do their best work. And so with some clumsiness, obviously, at first, I set out, and Pat Doherty was very much my colleague in arms in this, and we wanted to create a place that we would be really proud to be. And, I mean, we didn't know any better. So there weren't any old guys around to laugh at us and call us silly and what have you, because we wanted to create something. We would talk about it this way. People talked about working at the New York Herald Tribune when Jim Bellows was the editor and Thomas Wolfe was there and Gay Talese and Jimmy Breslin. And, of course, they talk about working at the Washington Post during the Bradley and Woodward and Bernstein. And we had it in our mind that we wanted to have a place that would be special, that special. And the funny thing is, if you believe in that and if you're trying to do that, it tends to attract other people who feel the same way and who feel challenged to rise to do their very best work. And to me, that was the most lasting thing I could do, or anybody could do, was to help build and inculcate that culture. I remember reading in a book about the New York Times, The Kingdom and the Power, Harrison Salisbury writes that during the Pentagon Papers crush, and for those of you who don't remember or don't know the details, the U.S. government was all over the New York Times to stop them from publishing the Pentagon Papers. The full weight of the Justice Department was leaning on the publisher. And Salisbury, at that point, wasn't in the loop. But he said, I saw the lights burning in the what they call the tower, the tall office building where the publishers and the lawyers were, while they made this momentous decision. He says, I never doubted for a moment what that decision would be because we were the kind of newspaper that would publish it. I knew we would publish it. And that I remember thinking, to have a culture that strong where, you know, it's the culture that's propelling the institution forward, that's the only kind of lasting contribution a person can make in something as transitory as news. And so, you know, we did a lot of things, some right and some wrong, some silly and some very effective. We introduced, and I write about this in the book, the notion of the tribal fire, being Alaska's tribal fire. And we had a little logo that Peter Dunlop-Scholl drew up for us. It's in the book. You can see it there. And our theory there was that in ancient times, people in a tribe must have gathered together, probably around a tribal fire, to tell the stories that defined themselves as a people. And so we wanted to be the place where Alaskans could tell the stories that defined themselves as a people. I think we recognize in a way that a lot of people didn't, that Alaskans wanted that kind of identification. They wanted a sense of place. They wanted a sense of belonging. And even though most of us were living in Anchorage in split-level houses and, you know, heated garages, still thought of it as being the frontier. And so we filled the paper with stories about the Iditarod and the toughest woman in Alaska and the Mount Marathon and everything we could think of, you know, that gave that authenticity. I remember one of my big regrets as an editor was we would typically have either five or six stories on the front page, and we would meet every day to decide what those were going to be. There was one day when I legitimately could have chosen five fish stories for the front page. There was like something from the government, a halibut allocation or something like that. There was a record king salmon caught down in Soldotna. There was, I don't remember what it was, but why did I pass that up? I was too responsible, I guess, at the time. So I put something out there probably about the United Nations or something. But generally, I think we did a good job. And here's another important point. In those days, winning meant doing better than the Anchorage Times. It wasn't a high bar. and they were, we can talk about their politics or anything of that, and that's really not what I'm talking about at the moment, though. I'm talking about their relationship with their readers. They really saw themselves as the voice, and you were supposed to sit there and listen to it. They would not publish a letter critical of themselves. They had a list, either spoken or perhaps written, of people whose names could not appear in the paper. And so we went out of our way to be the opposite. We published probably 10 times more letters to the editor than the Seattle Times, much less the Anchorage Times. We had the Compass columnists, the community columnists, that we would go out and try and select every 6 months a group of people who were very different than we were. My favorite, I remember, was a guy who owned a gun store. And, you know, we gave him a column for 6 months. And I got asked again and again and again through my career, said, Anchorage is a pretty conservative community, and the Times is much more conservative than you guys. How could you have won that war? And to me, it really wasn't even a surprise, because what I know is that Americans don't care if you have an opinion as long as you listen to their opinion, as long as they feel like there's a fair debate, as long as, you know, it represents the broad community. And so the fact was, I think people knew that we were listening to them as well as talking to them, and that they were part of the Daily News and could participate with us. And that was probably, in the end, the secret sauce.
So I'm glad you bring up the Times. one of the things that I was thinking about is in the beginning of the book, you know, you're talking about all of the things that are wrong with the times. And one of the things is that it was trying to be everything to everybody, you know, because it was sort of like it was the paper of record and the Daily News was the underdog. So when the Times went away, how did the identity of the Daily News change? And how were you able ever to articulate as clear of a mission for the paper once it was no longer the underdog?
Several pretty good questions there. One giant thing that happened is as soon as the Times went away, we no longer had them as a measuring stick, right? Remember I told you that for us to be successful, we just had to be better than the Times. Well, when the Times went away, we got measured not against the Anchorage Times, but against everyone's abstract sense of perfection. And we were a lot better at beating the Times than we were hitting everybody's abstract sense of perfection. And so the Daily News suffered in a sort of general way with some disillusionment, I think, on people who, God, the Times is gone and there's no unicorns. You know, what is going on here? And so we felt some of that internally as well. We had talked a lot about a peace dividend in the newsroom, that once we beat the Times and the war is over, there'll be all this extra money left over that used to go into the war that we could then use to, you know, hire more people and get raises and all that sort of thing. And, of course, I say of course on the basis of another 30 years' experience in business, it was the opposite. We did not retrench greatly right at first, but we began to retrench right then. And the fact is that when you aren't in a war, you don't build as many tanks and you don't field as many divisions, and we didn't either. But the paper was still very large. The newsroom was large. The staff size was large for our size circulation, and the talent level was more or less off the chart. So we had a good newspaper, and we continued to have, I think, the same kinds of aspirations, but it was different. Our relationship with the community was a little different. I was personally not as fired up every day to go to work. You know, I took a year off immediately after the Times folded. I figure if I'm ever going to ask McClatchy for a year off, this is the time to do it. They felt pretty good about us right then. And so I took a year off and went back to school and fully expected to come back and edit the Anchorage Daily News until I died or got fired or something. But it really felt different to me when I got back. And that's always a complicated calculus and involves a lot of things, not just the job, but I was 45, and I thought if I'm going to make a change, you know, it's easier to do it when you're 45 than 55. And but it was without question this absence of the competition, the direct competition, the easy, straightforward competition, sort of diminished my enthusiasm for it. And in any case, not very long after that, the Times folded in the summer of 1992, and I left in the fall of 95. So I wasn't really here that long after the Times folded. I remember one day after I got back from England, where I went to school, I was a year behind everybody else. Everybody else had been living with the absence of the Times for a year, and for me it was still fresh. And I was walking down the middle of the newsroom, and it was as if a cold hand just grabbed me, and I thought, oh, Christ, I haven't read the Times. You know, and I read the Times most days of my life closer than I read the Daily News. And then, of course, almost instantly, I said, oh, God, there is no Times. And it was literally to me, it wasn't. The effect on me was the same as if one of the Chugach Mountains had disappeared. You know, something I had seen every day of my life, and you walk out there, and it's just not there. It's different. And so it was almost disorienting. And so I grappled with that, and then other things changed. And I try to talk about this in the book, and so rather than go through a litany of my personnel complaints and so on, you can read that at your leisure.
One of the things that I noticed about the book is the way that your sort of self-image changed as a journalist. I mean, in the beginning, it's clear that
I wasn't intending to write about that. But what do you mean?
Well, in the beginning, it was clear that, like, being a journalist was service to self, right? I mean, you saw that byline and you thought it was pretty sweet, and don't we all?
Yes.
But then as you became the editor, you took on this more responsibility and you saw journalism more as service to community. But I think every journalist deals with those two things, service to self and service to something larger. And I wondered if you've thought, given that some thought, that idea of like, well, why am I doing this? Am I doing this because I want to, you know, win an award? Am I doing this because I want to expose corruption? You know, I wonder if you've given that sort of thing, any thought, and if you could talk about that.
Yeah. I guess pretty much every day I've given it some thought, or most days. And I think I always knew, at least I feel like I always knew it was a mixture of those things, that it was a calculus, not a point in time or space. Although initially it was just, it was so much fun, you know, so that's selfish, I guess. That is pretty much purely selfish. I loved the atmosphere. I loved the pace. I loved the smart aleck people who sat next to me, you know. I loved the cigarette butts in the newsroom. I loved it all. It was romantic to me. I saw a chance to have an impact on the community that I never expected, coming from, you know, my background, to have. And so that was all very seductive, and that never stopped, really. I never stopped loving the possibilities that were there. And then at some point, of course, it does become mitigated, I guess, or maybe watered down by the fact that you realize paper's got to come out every day. Somebody's got to cover stories they don't like to cover once in a while. Somebody's got to do this. Somebody's going to need to get fired. You know, it becomes the sort of real world intrudes on you as you get more and more responsibility for what's going on there. And like any, I suspect, position in life, you find out that there's a difference between daily reality and the set of ideals and aspirations you started with. And not everybody lives up to them all the time, including owners and management and editors and staffers. But what makes it work, I think, in the end, is if that's true more than it's not, and you recognize that you do have a chance to have some impact. And I love the idea that we got to start basically every day fresh. You know, I remember hearing somewhere early in my career somebody said, doctors bury their mistakes and lawyers send their mistakes to jail and architects plant ivy. But a reporter makes a mistake, we put her name on it and send it to everybody in town. And you get, you know, it's a very quick feedback. And so you hear from people when you've done something wrong. In a town the size of Anchorage, then or now, it's retail. It's not wholesale, right? You're dealing with the people that you write about every day. And, you know, Gail Collins isn't. Maureen Dowd isn't. They don't see those people. They write whatever mean shit they want and go on. And sometimes they deserve to, you know, say those things. I'm not saying it's wrong. But I know from my own experience that working in your hometown is a different kind of thing. I can remember a time when I made a rookie mistake. I was trying to decide whether we should run the Dr. Ruth sex column in the newspaper. And I'm old enough that that was still an issue in those days, as mild as Dr. Ruth would seem to us today. And I just wasn't sure what to do. And the rookie mistake I made was ask the readers what they thought. Because, you know, in the end, I was going to have to make the decision anyway, so all I could do was make them mad, you know, really. But I didn't know that at the time, so I asked. We ran the column for 2 weeks on a test basis and then asked people to write in, and I got almost 600 letters over that. What happened was the Anchorage Baptist Temple decided to make a crusade out of it, but because they did, the other sort of oppositional community in Anchorage decided they would write too. So I'm getting, and it's almost 50-50, of course, and I just don't know what to do until I got to one letter that said, "Dear Howard, it's been a long time since I had you in my Sunday school class. But if your mother were still alive, I know she would want me to." Now, you cannot argue with that letter.
No, you're done. You're toast.
You can say, "Yes, ma'am," and do what she said, you're which toast. I did, and I killed the column. And I suppose I can get away with telling one further addendum to that story is that that year, after I made that decision, at the company Christmas party, the person who drew my name gave me a present, which was a foam-matted portrait of Dr. Ruth with writing on it as if she had autographed it. And it said, "Dear Howard, don't you think you ejected me from the paper a little prematurely?"
Wah, wah.
I kept that on my wall for a long, long time to remind me never to make that rookie mistake again. And I don't think I did. Do you remember where this question started?
Yes, all right. We're cool. We're
sorry,
cool.
Sorry, I'm not trying
that's
to
what's awesome buster. About interviewing Howard Weaver, my friends. Like, he'll just come, he'll have a fabulous story no matter what you ask him. So one thing, and we were talking about this just briefly before we started, about my impression at the end of the book was it felt sad. And I say that because there's a part of it where you are talking about leaving the paper and you say, Alaska broke my heart. Can you talk about what that, where that came from, what that's about?
I can talk about it. I don't know if I can explain it. I'm not sure that I understand it. But a couple of years after we left, there was a sort of precipitating incident here. A couple of years after we left, I was asked to write a book that an Anchorage person had written about the oil industry, Jack Roderick's book about the history of the Alaska oil industry. And I was flattered to be asked, and I adore Jack, and I wanted to do a good job. So I wrote this introduction and found out that I showed it to my wife, who has always been my best first editor. And she read it, and she said, this is pretty good, but Howard, this is really pretty bitter. And I hadn't intended it to be bitter, so I took that to heart, and I rewrote the thing, and I sent it in to the publishing house. And I got a note back from the editor at the publishing house who said, you know, Howard, this is really bitter. And that was really bitter number two. I'd already toned it down once. And so I wrote it again, and I guess it was okay, and it showed up in the book. And but what it caused me to do was reflect on why I felt the way I felt. And then shortly after that, Mike Dugan asked me to write a chapter in an anthology that he was putting together. I think it was Mike. Called Our Alaska or something. And I was picked to be the guy who wrote about leaving Alaska, which made sense because, I mean, I was as much a lifer as anybody could have been. I was born here. I adored it. I worked here. I had great success here. I had every reason to want to stay, and I didn't. So in thinking about what to write for that book, I actually sort of articulated this notion that I did leave because I was so disappointed that my dreams for Alaska didn't seem to be reflected hardly at all in the direction things were going. Of course, there were great things happening, as there are great things happening here and elsewhere continuously. But for me, at least, I felt like I had poured my life into this effort to, based on one basic premise, that if people know the truth, they will make the right decisions, the good decisions, sound decisions, not my decisions, but that's a really crucial element. And yet, here we had, the Corrupt Bastards Club. We had the Exxon Valdez broke a lot of hearts while the oil was in the water and after that. For me, the worst part of it came later. This is the way I remember it. This is an emotional response, not a one that I've investigated. But as I remember it, Alaskans did, at some point after that spill, sort of stiffen up, and they started to fund the Department of Environmental Conservation again, at least a little better. You know, they passed some tanker safety regulation that was more comprehensive. They had a better oversight, changed the oil taxes some, eliminated the ELF. There were some things that happened, and I thought, well, maybe Alaska's relationship with this colonial interest that's taking root here will be different. And, you know, I never blamed oil companies for acting like oil companies, right? I expected them to act like oil companies. That's what they do, and in some paradigm, that's what they're supposed to do. There are these corporations, they want to maximize their profits, and they're going to take advantage of opportunities to do that. What broke my heart was that Alaskans were willing to go along with that to the degree that I saw us doing. And so I suppose heartbroken over that, and I really didn't read the end of the book quite as sad as you did, but I understand what you're saying.
Well, maybe it's not sad. Maybe that's just
I actually got a little lecture from Rich Maurer once over this, too. I had talked to him about some of the things that didn't happen as a result of our assiduous efforts, and he was good enough to help me counterbalance that with a list of some things that did happen. I mean, for one thing, I cannot believe and do not believe that this would be a better place if we had lost and the Times had won. I believe that the Daily News has stayed steadfast in extraordinarily difficult circumstances to do the best it can do. And I think that the future will be better. So in that sense, I've not despairing. It was just my sense that my best efforts had not done everything I'd hoped they would do. And so I'm not finished thinking about that, and so I don't want to come to a conclusion.
You can always come back as Professor Emeritus. We'll save you.
You know what I get to do next week? Just by chance, I called Brian O'Donohue at the University in Fairbanks, and I had a deal to sign some books at Gulliver's up there. And I thought maybe I could go to some of the journalism classes and talk. Well, anyway, it turns out he was desperate to find a person to speak at an endowed lecture series they have there. And so next week I'm going to give the C.W. Sneddon lecture, which is just slightly not as good as becoming the Atwood Professor of Journalism. So anything's possible, Julia. I won't deny it.
All right, cool. I'll write that down. So not to continue on this sort of, but I guess, I mean, a memoir is retrospective in some ways. So, but I wonder if you could talk about the decision to leave McClatchy and what led you to that.
Yes, I can. I wasn't able to make a positive contribution anymore. I left McClatchy. What was it? 3 years ago, I think 4 years ago, as the devastation of American newspapers sort of really started to take traction. It had been true for a while, since 2006 was when the recession started. Things got tough. McClatchy had just borrowed basically $6 billion to buy Knight Ridder, had debt service. But the whole industry was being hurt. And I actually have thought a lot about what happened there, and we can talk about that. But for me personally, I was the vice president for news. I was the chief editorial officer of the company. And we had just gone through, I think, two rounds of buyouts, layoffs in newsrooms, which I thought were, you know, as much as could conceivably be done. And another round came up, and I articulated my position about that, and it made absolutely no difference. And that's not why I left, because I left because I understood why it made no difference. I understood that there was no chance that this could be avoided. The newspapers could not survive without fairly draconian measures. Not to say I agree with every decision. I think some other places could have been cut more first. I think there were failures on the sales side. You know, it's a complex industry and a complex equation, but I knew for a fact that the next several years at least were going to be preoccupied with that, and I simply wasn't making a positive contribution. I didn't know how to do that. I didn't know how to take things apart, you know, I didn't want to, and I was lucky, personally lucky, because I was 58 years old, but I had worked for the company long enough that I could just retire. I didn't have to wait for a buyout. I didn't take a buyout or anything else. I simply retired, and, you know, at a time when I had enough energy left to try some other things and when I could change my situation, and I felt guilty. I felt like I was running away from the fight, but I also knew that I wasn't going to make any very positive contribution to that fight. I could go around and maybe help morale a little bit. I could maybe change the slope of the curve a little bit, but I could see what was going to happen. And I felt really almost like I was taking their money for no good reason, because they didn't have to pay me a couple hundred, $3,000, $300,000 a year to have no effect. You know, it was ridiculous. And so I thought, really, in a way, I was making a better contribution by not taking that salary than I was by staying there. So, but the short answer to that, the honest answer, is I just hurt too bad, you know. And if I'd thought I could hurt that bad and save some of it, I would have stayed. But I didn't think I could. So whether I could or not, that was my decision, and that's why I did it. I have a great deal of respect for the folks at McClatchy. And I've been asked, and expect I will be asked, you know, what about the period after you left? You know, the Daily News is a smaller newspaper than it was. It has a much smaller staff. It's necessarily, based on those two things, has a different set of ambitions. And all of those things are true. But that's really not a uniquely McClatchy problem or uniquely Anchorage Daily News problem. The fact is that quite a few newspaper companies are just flat gone. The Tribune Company is bankrupt and gone. The Media News Company is bankrupt and gone. Freedom Newspapers is bankrupt and gone. McClatchy is not bankrupt, and I don't think, this is not insider information, but I don't think they will. I think they will make it. And then I think that can be the beginning of a rebuilding. It's going to take people with a lot of fortitude to do that. And it wasn't for me to do. You know, I wasn't the one to do that. But I think it will happen, and I'm relatively sanguine about that. I think that a new journalism ecosystem will emerge, and I think that the foundation of it will be the sorts of disciplines and ethics and standards that have been espoused by traditional good newspapers. Well, sure. Would you sell yours? I do own stock. I bought McClatchy stock throughout my employment there. One of the benefits we got was discounted stock. We could buy it cheaper than the market price, and I bought whatever the limit was every time. So I have stock left. I was also a big part of my salary was stock options. And McClatchy stock's trading somewhere a little under $3, I think, now. And a good number of my stock options are at 70, so I'm not holding my breath on those. But, you know, that's just the value of newspapers changed dramatically. And there were a couple of things. Is it okay to talk about this now?
Yeah, go for it. I was going to ask you.
Please.
He can interview himself, really.
And we all know what that's called. The newspaper industry, basically, we were terribly worried that the internet, the online digital world, was going to steal our audience, right? We thought, oh, my God, they're going to take the audience away from us. Well, it turns out that is not what happened, and it wasn't the biggest threat, and, in fact, it didn't even come to pass. I'm being encouraged to raise this. What happened was that the digital world stole our revenue, and the way it happened is this. If you take the Anchorage Daily News, for example, and take the circulation of the printed newspaper today and add to that the unduplicated reach of its online audience, more people they have a bigger audience today than when I was there by a considerable margin. What they don't have is as many advertisers who need to buy that to get that audience. What happened was a multitude of other opportunities to reach audiences came along. You know, if you're interested in hockey, you can go to the dailynews.com, adia.com sports page, or you can go to anchorageaces.com, or, you know, to any number of other sites. And so that audience became fragmented. And all along, I mean, I had known for a long time in my career that although our mission was to tell the truth to power, our business was to aggregate audiences and sell them to advertisers. That's what newspapers did. And the absence of the need for that aggregation is really at the heart of what has starved newspapers into the situation they are right now. One additional factor that came along was that the single most lucrative kind of advertising in newspapers was classified ads. And that was a monopoly, basically, for newspapers, because Budweiser or Pepsi Cola or somebody could advertise on television. But if you were selling your used car, you couldn't advertise on television. If you were hiring, you know, three guys to work in the lumberyard, you couldn't advertise on television. So you bought classified ads. And because they were essentially a monopoly, newspapers charged a ton of money for them and made a ton of profit. Well, Craigslist, okay? Craigslist came along, and what a few years ago, 10 years ago or less, was a $20 billion a year revenue stream, more or less went away. Craigslist makes about $100 million a year, which is a nice bit of money, but it's a tiny fraction of $20 billion. And that's because they give away most of the ads. And, I mean, that is hard to – well, first of all, it's hard to compete against that. But secondly, it's a good thing in most ways, right? Craigslist is easier to use. It's free. You can digitally – all classifieds should be digital. You can search them. You know, you can put alerts in there. It's just a better way to serve that marketplace. And there wasn't a goddamn thing we could do about that. People said, how come the newspaper business didn't invent Craigslist? Well, okay, we could have given away the ads instead of Craig giving them away, but that would not have solved this problem. So anyway, the problems that come from the loss of all that revenue, I think, were inevitable. It was going to happen. Now, the newspaper industry could have been a lot smarter about preparing for it, about fighting against it. I could have been a lot better about trying to understand how to frame the arguments I made at the corporate offices better. I didn't understand the commercial side of the business as well as I needed to make sure we were trying to change as quick on that side of the house as we were on the news side. But basically, I feel like the newsrooms did not fail in that because those audiences are still there. When more people today want what you do than wanted it yesterday, it's hard to call that a failure. But the world changes, you know. The world changes. And I can remember writing stories about pulp mills closing in Ketchikan, and all the loggers were saying, we have a right to, you know, these jobs. I've worked in this job for 40 years. Nobody told them, you know, anything except goodbye. And so that kind of thing happens. And so I admire, more than admire, the institutions and the people who are kind of keeping the flame alive, because I do think it will catch again, and I do think that that will be the genesis of it.
Has the job of a newspaper like the Daily News changed? Has the purpose of the paper changed as the world has changed around it, the environment?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely it has, and that's because the environment around it has changed. Most of my career, I occupied what we referred to as a gatekeeper role, right? I was the editor of the biggest paper in the state, and I could decide what went into the Daily News and didn't. I could decide what we put three reporters on and what we ignored. I could decide a lot of things. And I took that very seriously, and I tried to do a good job at that. I think I managed to get some pretty good stuff in the newspaper that some important people didn't want in there. And sometimes I kept some stuff out of the paper that some of the staff did want in there, and I tried my very best to be a good gatekeeper for the people of Alaska. But that doesn't matter. That is gone forever. One of the McClatchy board members asked me a few years ago, what is the biggest single change that the Internet has brought to newspapers? And I had to think for a minute because there's a lot of them, right? The 24-hour news cycle, the tools that you have now with video and, you know, an instant alerts and what have you. But I settled on this one, the total erosion of the gatekeeper model. And when I would go to the McClatchy newsrooms to talk to the editors about that, I would say, look, it's just you can stand at the gate if you want, but you're going to look pretty silly because the fence is down and all the people are over there, right? And so that's a huge change. The hierarchy throughout most of history, really, the hierarchy of information has been smart on the top, dumb on the bottom. There was a TV station, and the information filtered from the TV station to the audience, or from the newspaper to the audience, or from the government to the people. And that's just not true anymore. Now it's more like a geodesic design. Things are all interconnected through and through. And, you know, people can, it doesn't really matter anymore if the New York Times decides to publish a story or not, because the Drudge Report will. And when the Drudge Report does, it becomes news. And it becomes a part of the environment and a part of what you have to deal with as journalists. And so absolutely the role has changed. What hasn't changed, I hope, is this. And if I'm wrong about this part, I'm just totally wrong. Because I built my career on the belief that verified, quality, authenticated information is simply more valuable than rumors and opinions. Not that it's more righteous, although I think it is. Not that it's the right thing, although I think it is. But that it's more valuable. And look, think about it for a second. Throughout history, presidents and popes and kings have hired spies so that they would have higher quality information than their enemies. Investors hire analysts so that they'll have information other investors don't have. It should mean something that the information has been authenticated in some way. And so if it is true that there's value to that, which I believe there is, if you're a partner in a law firm and you're the only one in the law firm that knows what the city council has done about the zoning, you're going to be more valuable to that law firm probably. If there's a value to it, I think that we will come up with a system in which supplying that kind of information can be economical. There will be an economy around that. And the fact is that newspapers had such a huge expense burden to carry because they had grown up over many, many years as dominant, prosperous institutions, and they were very inefficient. They operated with a technology that was very demanding. Tons of ink per year had to be shipped to Anchorage, Alaska. Hundreds of thousands of tons of newsprint There was a huge plant that operated 18, 24 hours a day and so on. That's just not true about most of today's information infrastructure. And so somebody will figure out a way to create an infrastructure that both captures the efficiencies and can still fund people to help sort and filter that information. Because I just don't believe that people are well-served or ultimately going to be satisfied with a sort of undifferentiated fire hose of information coming at them every day.
So we were talking about this also a little bit briefly, but recently Facebook bought Instagram, and Instagram's value was, I think, around that of the New York Times.
And it was $1 billion for a one-year-old company with no revenue.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you, I mean, clearly that sort of thing, user-generated content that's shared over social networks, that kind of thing is like taking over the world. How does that inform the job of a journalist, and how does that inform, the mission of a newspaper?
The analogy that I found easier to grasp was this, because they happened in the same week. Instagram was worth $1 billion, and Kodak went bankrupt, And so that, to me, was a sobering kind of parallel. Social networks are indeed taking over the world, or, whatever you had said there. But you have to remember, some appreciable part of what people like to share on social networks is news. And some that news comes from somewhere. Some of it can be, press releases from Hollywood press agents, I guess. But there's a good bit of it that people want to know. What's going on in other parts of the world. They want to know how their government is behaving. They want to know if they're being spied on by the New York City Police Department. They want to know how the legislature met in secret to pass the budget. Those things matter. And so that information, despite the fact that it fuels, it's a part of the fuel in social media sharing, it doesn't originate in social media by and large. And so there again, I believe there will be a way that the delivery of that information can make money, whether it comes as a, some sort of residual payment like does with ASCAP and songs. Every time a song plays on the radio, theoretically, the guy who wrote it gets a little tiny bit of money without anybody going out and collecting it, or whether it comes from, the news division of Facebook. I don't know. But I do know that people are going to continue to want that. One of my favorite quotes in my news days was from Mark Twain, who once said, "I don't worry about ever having a job because I'm a journalist. And I figure that the people in the north of hell are going to care about what the people in the south of hell have been up to." And I feel like that's going to be true.
So let's just pretend. Howard is an expert, if you don't know him, which pretty much all of you do, but Howard's an expert sloganeer. He has a slogan for anything. And I mean, I've been at the Daily News on and off for 17 years, and his slogans are still being passed around. Sheila will be like, "This lead is a lightning bug, not a lightning bolt," something like that. But
I also stole that from Mark Twain, by the way.
All right. Well, anyway, I wondered, let's say you were in the position of having to confront a newsroom like ours, and I know what we've been through. What would be your slogan for us?
I think my slogan would be "Don't give up the ship," because when you stop fighting is when you've lost, right? There's no alternative to that. And if you don't keep... If you don't stay in the game, the opportunities will never arise. There's a great quote from the guy who was the leader of the Scottish Himalayan expedition, in which he says, basically, and I can't quote this one verbatim, but he says, "There is a power that moves once you begin to move that will never move otherwise. And providence opens doors that you would never otherwise have seen." And he goes on at some length about that and says, "This reminds me of the fundamental truth of Goethe's great couplet, which is, whatever you can do or think you can, begin it. Boldness has power and genius and magic in it." And so if you're not fighting, you lost, okay? Don't stop fighting. And I think that, as I say, I really think that there's a good reason to believe, not just to hope, but to believe that these solutions will emerge. Here's what I think, really. I think back 40 years ago to that dirty newsroom down on Post Road. I think back to the grimy little bar room on Front Street where John Greeley and I sat and dreamed up the Alaska Advocate. We didn't have a fucking idea what was going to happen, right? We didn't have a clue. And if we had had a clue, we probably wouldn't have done it. I mean, if we had known what a long shot it was, if we had known how, you know, sort of arrogant we must have seemed, we might have just sat still. But we didn't. And we wanted to find a way to practice a journalism that was informed by our generation, by Watergate, by Vietnam, by the Pentagon Papers. And so we went to work on that. And by gosh, 40 years later, we had some success with that. There is a media ecology. It has worked. It has served the public rather well in the last 40 years. And so I'm counting on you guys. I mean, and you're going to have to figure out how to create a journalism that is informed by your generation and that meets the needs of this generation. And I don't think the odds are any longer. And I think there's every reason to think you can do it, and I know there is every reason to try. I got asked quite a bit when I was the McClatchy VP by young people. They would say, Mr. Weaver, that's how I knew I was in the newsroom. Mr. Weaver, if you were my age, would you go into journalism? And I was able to say with complete truthfulness and confidence, yes, I would, and for exactly the reasons I did it 40 years ago. I wanted a career where I could make a difference. I wanted to be able to, you know, make something valuable for my community. I wanted to work around smart aleck, articulate people. I wanted to stick my nose in where it didn't belong. I wanted to have some fun. And all of those things are still available. And you can find ways to deliver them. Will the McClatchy Company survive? Will the New York Times Company survive? I think so, but if they don't, I don't think that means news is dead.
All right, then. I think we might have to forego in questions in the interest of time. Well, I don't know.
Are there any really hard ones? We should take them.
Because you haven't had any of those today. Well, I can't really read the handwriting in this one.
Well, that makes that easy.
Yeah, so that one's out. Well, in this one you sort of answered, but it says, entry-level journalists in Alaska and elsewhere make less than some student workers at UAA. How do we attract the best and brightest to the field if the pay is poverty level?
You should ask the guy that hired me. He did it.
I don't think you do it for the pay.
Exactly. And neither did I, and neither did Rich Maurer, and neither did the people who care a lot about it. They need to be paid well. And journalism has changed dramatically. Journalism was just, 50 years ago, very much a craft. And the guys who did it often had not, you know, some didn't have high school diplomas, much less college diplomas. Nobody studied journalism and so on. Well, as the world has become more sophisticated and complex, so has journalism. Not always for the good. I think that it has introduced a degree of distance between journalists and their audiences that might be disadvantageous. But basically, you're not going to be able to cover the crash of Wall Street derivative markets unless you have some sophistication yourself. So it does have to be. But fortunately, a good part of the wage is a social wage, and it's not just money.
Oh.
Hey, Barb.
Here's the man.
Says, shut up.
Oh, the press club table is shutting down. People need to claim their stuff. All right. Okay, well, don't anybody take my breast pump now. All right. Anyway, okay, this is the last question. Do you have anything good to say about Bill Allen?
His newspaper is gone, and so is he.
All right, and there you have it, friends.
For more info, or if you have an event to podcast, go to greenandgold.uaa.alaska.edu/podcasts.